Good day, and welcome to the American Constitution Society's The President's Executive Action on Immigration Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Zachary Gima. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm Zachary Gima, Associate Director of Strategic Engagement at the American Constitution Society. Thank you for joining us for today's call, The President's Executive Action on Immigration, co-sponsored with the Hispanic National Bar Association. Please note that today's call is being recorded, and we will provide the recording to you after the call. 1 half hour of California CLE credit is available for this call, and please email Alicia Yass at ayass@acslaw.org to get credit. We will invite you to ask questions at the end of this call. Judging from the RSVP list, we'd like to say welcome to several new friends to the American Constitution Society. For those of you not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. And because today is Giving Tuesday, I wanted to give an extra pitch for everyone to become a formal part of our network and become a member of ACS today. Giving Tuesday was established by the nonprofit and philanthropic community as a day of giving back. And if you join now, your membership will be current through 2015, and you'll support all of the critical programming, like this call, that ACS does throughout the year. Please also help us to tell your friends and colleagues about ACS and encourage them to join the Giving Tuesday movement. For more information and to sign up for ACS, please visit acslaw.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's speakers, Clarissa Martinez and Erwin Chemerinsky. Clarissa is the Deputy Vice President of the Office of Research, Advocacy, and Legislation at the National Council of La Raza. In this position, she oversees La Raza's work on immigration and efforts to expand Latino engagement in civic life and public policy debate. Clarissa previously was the Director of State Advocacy at La Raza, the Manager for the Coalition for Comprehensive Immigration Reform, the Assistant Director of the California-Mexico Project at the University of Southern California, and has held other numerous roles in the immigration and labor movement. She will speak today about the political atmosphere that brought about the President to act and the details of the announcement. Clarissa will then turn over to Erwin Chemerinsky to discuss the President's constitutional and statutory authority to take action on immigration. Erwin is the founding dean and distinguished professor of law and Raymond Prake Professor of First Amendment Law at the University of California, Irvine, with a joint appointment in political science. His areas of expertise are constitutional law, federal practice, civil rights and civil liberties, and appellate litigation. He's the author of 8 books, including The Case Against the Supreme Court, published in 2014, and more than 200 articles in top law reviews, and several recent blog posts for the ACS blog. Erwin is a longtime friend of ACS and continues to be one of our greatest supporters. And with that, I'll turn the call over to Clarissa.
Thank you, Zach, and thanks, everybody, for joining this call today. We really look forward to your questions and comments because we always learn a great deal from that give and take and engaging with people in this very timely conversation. I was asked to really focus on how did we get here, how did we get to where we are today, and what was 2 weeks ago incredibly the biggest development we've had in immigration in the last 25 years, which is a sad statement. But that also is part of the reason why we are where we are. The biggest piece of legislation in this arena was under IRCA, which was that long ago in the 80s. And I think as part of the debate, you often hear in the discussions in the debate that people saying whatever we do with the undocumented population today, we want to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes we made under IRCA, because at that point, when there was a legalization program through legislation, we told the American public that we, you know, that was going to take care of the problem. So in many ways, what happened then is part of the reason why we are where we are today. And in many ways, it has to do with not what is the dominant element in this discussion. A lot of the immigration conversation, the lightning rod is always how are we going to deal with the undocumented population, and a lot of the debate focuses on that for a number of reasons. But part of the reason for the growth of that population has a great deal to do with how well or not our legal immigration system is working. And in order to really be able to address that, we need legislation, which is why over the last couple of decades, there's been a lot of efforts to try to get legislation done. But what do I mean by that? Under IRCA, there were a number of steps taken, particularly that legalization program, which at the time covered several million people. I think it was 3 million. It was the size of the population at the time that would have been able to apply under IRCA. However, while there were other measures that were put in place, there was not really a critical overhaul of the legal immigration system that will allow that would allow us to have the elasticity needed to respond to changes in our demands, both from the economic front and from the family front, which are the two cornerstones of our immigration system. So largely speaking, although there are other means and channels, people who come to our country tend to come because of our relationship with an employer or our relationship to a family member here. And again, we haven't seen true, meaningful wrangling with that system since. There's been a lot of patchworks and different groups trying to make headway or increase the number of visas available for their particular sector. But we haven't dealt with the system overall. And as we know, while people try to compartmentalize the conversation on Capitol Hill, the enforcement piece works in tandem with the legal immigration piece, works in tandem with our temporary programs. And when one of those pieces is broken, the other ones are also going to experience problems. Particularly in the mid to late 2000s, there were some very significant efforts to get legislation done. And the Senate at the time had managed to pass a bill, which similarly to where we're heading right now, expired without the House responding to that bill. The House had passed very restrictive legislation, that did not come to fruition, which at the time would have had the effect of criminalizing undocumented persons, and led to the massive peaceful demonstrations that many of you may remember where a combined millions of people went to the streets in a lot of cities across the country. But then the last big push was in 2007, and we did not manage to get a bill out of the Senate then. That was under President Bush, who obviously believed in getting immigration reform done and had fought to get that done. But after the failure of that legislation, what we did see was an increase focused on enforcement. And it has taken many different forms, going from very showy, highly visible worksite rates which have now been discredited both in terms of their effectiveness for stemming the flow of the undocumented population, but also because of its terrorizing effects on the communities where they took place. So as a matter of fact, under President Obama, when he came in, there was a move away from worksite raids. But as we know, there has been a continuation of enforcement that has led to a record number of deportations in the undocumented population. And while there's been a lot of talk about what is the focus of those deportations and trying to put the focus on people who pose a threat to national security or to public safety, the reality felt by communities as well as documented is that the majority of the people who have been removed have been people who did not have a criminal record. So in the midst of all this, you can imagine the the reverberations of that kind of activity where you have over 2 million people being deported, people who are parts of families and communities who are feeling that impact, and many times those folks being the breadwinner for that particular family, and at sometimes having both parents being removed and leaving citizen children behind who then had to be placed in foster care or with other family members to take care of them, and in many ways having community systems trying to deal with the consequences of those actions. That led to increased pressure from immigrant and sister communities to try to change those policies. So you have an incredible push to try to change the policies that the administration is using, and this dates back to, obviously, Bush in previous years, to try to really look at how those policies are being implemented to make sure that they are really focusing on people who pose a real threat, and to take into account the consequences on U.S. citizen and legal permanent resident members of those families who are also being affected. So there's a pressure to change how the enforcement of the immigration laws is happening, both through the agency and in dealings with police, because the other thing that we started seeing in this time was an increased deputizing of local law enforcement and the application of immigration laws, which also had detrimental effects in terms of the relationships of communities with large immigrant populations and their willingness to interact with the police. And you can just imagine what kind of situations that can create, where either witnesses or victims of crime are going to think twice about coming forward and interacting with police. So, again, there's the mounting pressure on the enforcement side for the administration to use prosecutorial discretion to reexamine these policies after seeing intended or unintended consequences they were having. At the same time, there's an incredible push in Congress to get immigration reform done. And so to skip ahead quite a bit, we're looking now at the beginning of 2013 when there was mounting pressure on both Congress and the president to take action. The president had taken action with the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which at the time protected those we have come to know as DREAMers. Also who were part of a piece of legislation that had been languishing for 10 years. So in many ways, that legislation created parameters to what became the DACA program, although obviously the president doesn't have legislative authority, so it had to be done through the angle and lens of prosecutorial discretion. So when the Senate starts working on their bill, we are able to see that it wasn't an easy process by any means. It seems very easy now compared to what we've gone through in the last year and a half. But the Senate managed to pass a bipartisan bill on immigration. And it bears to note there that whenever immigration has succeeded, it has needed that bipartisan support. It has needed the ability for folks on both sides of the aisle to collaborate. And we very much saw that in the context of the Senate bill. When the House leadership continually kept moving the goalposts until it finally acknowledged that they would refuse to move forward on immigration reform, I think that what had been a very intense movement and pressure on the White House to act then became even more intense because that door, at least for the immediate, had been closed by Republican House leadership. And so then the pressure focused on the president to use his prosecutorial discretion to make changes both to the enforcement side as well as to look at the application of administrative action for an expansion, say, of a DACA program and a DACA-like program. So I think those conversations really, really intensified at the beginning of this year. led to announcements by the president about tasking the Department of Homeland Security to start looking at recommendations of what could be done. I think if you've been following this, you know that that's been delayed several times, first at the beginning of the summer. I think as part of the president trying to give as much latitude and space to Congress to move forward and act until that window was closed. Then after that, there was an additional delay at that time, responding to a handful of Senate Democrats who were worried about having to deal with this in their elections, which resulted in the president announcing that he would wait until after the election to announce what the recommendations and actions would be. And then I think that after the election was done, it was sort of a waiting game to see when that action would happen. And so we saw that action take place almost now 2 weeks ago. Again, going back to how we started, this is the most the most meaningful development in immigration in the last 25 years. It has the potential. We have to remember that the programs that are being structured were actually not part of an executive order. We're part of memorandum and recommendations of the Department of Homeland Security. And I'm sure you'll hear more about that when we get into the legal authority. But in many ways deal with the fact that because we haven't really tried to structure our immigration system in a way that it's more responsive to the needs of the country, we have seen the undocumented population grow. It has peaked, and we have seen a slight reduction since that peak a couple of years ago to where we stand now, which is approximately 11.5 million undocumented people. And it's really important to note that the majority of those people have actually been living in our country, I think over 60%, for more than 10 years. So if you think about that, you can start visualizing how they are indeed part of families with United States citizens, legal permanent residents. And so the two programs that are being structured right now are the expansion of the DACA program for Dreamers and the creation of a program for parents of U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents, plus some of the other recommendations put forth could have the ability potentially to close to 5 million people to apply and go through a process, which we should note, it's not pardoning a category of people. This is a case-by-case program. Each individual has to come forward, go through criminal background checks, pay their fees, and then determinations will be made individually for those folks. In any case, now we are going to be going forward in two tracks. I think that many of you, because of your legal backgrounds and where and the area of work that you do, part of that work is going to be navigating the process and helping as many people get good with the law as possible, which is what's going to let the country achieve the full benefit, even if temporary, on the national security and the economic side, with people going through criminal background checks and people who are working being able to work legally and paying more taxes. And the second track is going to be to defend this process, which, as you can see, has come under significant attack already, and much of that hinges on the legal authority and the president and the precedent for the president to do this, which is a segue into my colleague who comes next.
Thank you, Clarissa. It was wonderful to hear you. I learned so much from listening. I've been asked to talk about the legality of what the president announced on Thursday night, November 20th. My conclusion, having done a lot of research, is that the president's actions are clearly constitutional. There's a lot of heated Republican rhetoric about lawlessness, but what I would suggest to you is that what the president announced is squarely within the president's power, that it's actually consistent with statutory authority, and perhaps most important, what's gotten overlooked, it's consistent with both what Republican and Democratic presidents have done for years. Now, there are, of course, limits on what the president can do. The president cannot grant citizenship. Citizenship can be granted only when there's a statute that authorizes it. Nothing in the president's policy is granting citizenship where there's not statutory authorization for it. The president cannot change the legal status of individuals. Nothing about what the president's announcing is doing that. What I want to focus on is that what the president most of all has the authority to do is to set enforcement priorities. This is true in all areas of criminal law. It's true with regard to immigration law and deportation as well. As was pointed out, there are over 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. The United States can deport about 400,000 people a year. Inevitably, priorities have to be set about who to bring deportation proceedings against. What the president announced on November 20th, above all, was the enforcement priorities for his administration. He captured it in the expression saying, we want to deport felons, not families. And it's important to situate this announcement by the president in the broader context that there's always executive power to decide whether to prosecute. No government prosecutes all crimes. It would be administratively, it would be financially impossible. It would also be undesirable. Think of it in the simplest example. Generally, the police don't stop drivers for speeding unless they're going 10 miles or more over the speed limit. Never has the police been found required to stop everybody who's speeding, even a mile over the limit. There are silly laws on the books. There's silly laws at the state and local level. There's some silly federal laws. And the way that's dealt with is they're just not enforced. It's prosecutorial discretion. Or think of it in the federal government sense. The federal government doesn't prosecute people for possessing small amounts of marijuana, even though it violates the Federal Controlled Substance Act. There are internal guidelines in the United States Department of Justice that specify the amount of drugs that need to be present to justify a prosecution. Put it in the context of financial fraud, the number of stolen credit cards that have to be present in order for the federal government to prosecute, the size of the fraud that has to be involved for the federal government to prosecute. Never has the federal government prosecuted all crimes. Always priorities are set with regard to enforcement. Another simple example, rarely are there obscenity prosecutions today at the federal level, even though there are still federal obscenity laws. The Supreme Court on many occasions has recognized the existence of broad prosecutorial discretion. In United States versus Nixon, the Supreme Court said, quote, the executive branch has exclusive authority and absolute discretion whether to prosecute a case. This isn't new. In 1800, then-Congressman John Marshall said that the president may, quote, direct that the criminal prosecution go no further. That is the exercise of an indubitable presidential power. And you can find quotes from lower court judges, from Republican appointees and Democratic appointees about the existence of prosecutorial executive discretion. Just a year ago, D.C. Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh said, quote, the president may decline to prosecute certain violations of federal law, just as the president may pardon certain violations of federal law. The president may decline to prosecute because of the president's own constitutional concerns about the law or because of policy objections to the law, among other reasons. And the Supreme Court, in cases like Heckler versus Cheney in 1985, have reaffirmed the very broad discretion of agencies to decide whether to bring enforcement actions. So while it's generally true that presidents have broad authority whether and how to enforce the law, this is especially true with regard to immigration. The Supreme Court long has recognized that immigration enforcement is directly related to foreign policy, and the Supreme Court has often said that foreign policy is especially in the control of the president. In Hines versus Davidowitz in the early 1940s, the Supreme Court explained that states can't regulate immigration, that states can't have a foreign policy, that the United States has to decide its immigration policy to be in accord with the foreign policy it wants to pursue. This was emphasized by the Supreme Court just a couple of years ago in Arizona versus the United States. One of the provisions of Arizona's SB 1070 said that state and local police could detain an individual if there was probable cause that the person was not lawfully in the United States. The Supreme Court found that this provision was preempted by federal law. Justice Kennedy, writing for the court, emphasized that only the United States government can decide whether to bring deportation proceedings. That choice is often influenced by factors like humanitarian considerations and also foreign policy needs and considerations. And thus, the court said, you can't have a state deciding whether to hold somebody for deportation. That's exclusively in the discretion of the executive branch of the government. This idea that presidents have discretion to set enforcement priorities with regard to immigration is nothing new. What President Obama was announcing with regard to enforcement priorities, other presidents have done. Just to give a few of so many examples, in 1987, President Ronald Reagan said that there would not be deportation proceedings against 200,000 Nicaraguans who were not lawfully in the United States because of the United States policy with regard to Nicaragua at the time. In 1990, President George H.W. Bush allowed 1.5 million individuals to remain in the United States rather than face deportation because it was about implementing the 1996 law that was discussed just a few moments ago. President George H.W. Bush also said that there were certain Chinese students and then certain Kuwaiti students who were not lawfully here, but the government was not going to bring deportation proceedings against them. President Clinton, for example, decided to halt deportation proceedings against those from Haiti who are not lawful in the United States, and others who were from areas that were devastated by hurricanes. President George W. Bush, at the request of the President of El Salvador, decided not to bring deportation proceedings against a number of individuals who were not lawfully in the United States. President George Bush also decided as a matter of policy to allow those who were veterans to remain in the United States, even though they might be subject to deportation. And I give all of these examples just to indicate that what President Obama announced on November 20th has precedent from presidents going back, and I've just gone back to Ronald Reagan, but much further than that through American history. Now, what President Obama announced was, as I pointed out, he's setting enforcement priorities. He did say that there's going to be deferred action, which is a phrase that's been used by other presidents as well, for those who are not lawful in the United States, but have children who are citizens or lawful permanent residents. And there are a number of criteria for these deferred actions. It has to be individuals who continue in the United States since before January 1st, 2000. They have to have a child who's a United States citizen or lawful permanent resident. The person has to be physically present in the United States. There has to be no other reason for not having the person stay in the United States. Obviously, a person with a felony conviction would not qualify for this. And so as Clarissa was saying, it's very much an individualized determination. As I said at the outset of my remarks, this is not granting citizenship to anybody. It's not giving them legal status. It's deferred action. One of the things that didn't get enough attention in the media is there have been many instances of presidents giving deferred actions. So, for example, there's been deferred action to those who are victims of domestic violence. There's been deferred action in the past to those who are victims of human trafficking. There have been deferred action for those who were affected by Hurricane Katrina. There's been deferred actions for widows and widowers of United States citizens. There's been the deferred action of the Dreamers that was announced in 2012. And so here, too, you see that what President Obama has announced isn't new, it's not unprecedented, it's what's been done. Now, President Obama has expanded the deferred action for childhood arrivals, which is the Dreamers program, but again, this is part of what presidents have done with regard to the exercise of deferred action. I want to make one other point about the law here, and then we probably turn to questions, and that's, I don't think that anybody's going to have standing to go to court to challenge this. So there's a tremendous amount of rhetoric. There's even talk of impeaching the president or shutting down the government, neither of which I think is at all likely to happen. But the thing I don't think we're going to see are lawsuits brought against this, or at least lawsuits that can withstand a motion to dismiss. In order for there to be standing, there has to be somebody who's injured by the executive action. Those who are given deferred action and are going to be remaining here, they're not going to bring a lawsuit challenging this. Under well-established principles, members of Congress, however upset they are about this, aren't injured by it. They're not going to have standing to do it. The Supreme Court said in Raines versus Byrd, only if there's a complete disenfranchisement of Congress can members of Congress sue, and that's not the case here. There are many things that Congress could do, I don't think they're likely to do, to overturn this. So I think the legal discussion is a very important one to have. I think the media has not accurately reported it in many instances, but I also think when we talk about the legal discussion, it's important to keep in mind, probably it's not one that's going to be resolved in the courts, because I just don't see you as standing to sue.
Thank you, Erwin. And Justin, could you provide the instructions for people how to ask their own questions?
Well, certainly. If you would like to signal with a question, please press *1, your touch-tone telephone. If you happen to be joining us today with a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that will be *1 if you would like to signal with questions.
Great. Next, I have a question that came in over email from Ney Montenegro. The president and his legal advisors have said that the president legally cannot build a deferred action on top of another deferred action, as the reason why the president could not grant deferred action to the parents of Dreamers. Do you think that this self-imposed limitation was an actual legal limitation, a political calculation, or both?
I don't see why, in terms of the law, the president can't do this. I don't know of any case that would say the president couldn't do this. And if you think of deferred action as ultimately choices with regard to enforcement priorities, the Office of Legal Counsel released a memo that's now publicly available where they expressed concerns about the extension of deferred action for childhood arrivals. And I just don't agree with the Office of Legal Counsel memo here. They also wanted to emphasize that there should be case-by-case determinations. First, there is that here. And second, I don't see where that comes from. So I think the bottom line is the president gets to choose whether to bring enforcement actions. That includes whether to bring deportation proceedings. Deferred action is a choice to not bring certain deportation proceedings. I don't see any reason why you can't have multiple layers or levels of that.
Thank you. And I think we have questions in the queue now.
Yes, we'll take a question from Howard Wayne with the State of California Attorney General's Office.
Thank you. Professor, we've been treated to clips on the television which show the president repeatedly denying he had the authority to take steps, which he apparently subsequently has. How do you square his prior comments with what you've said?
The prior comments that I've heard indicated the president's recognition of his limited authority. And, for example, as I said at the beginning, the president does not have the authority to grant citizenship. The president does not have the authority to change somebody's legal status. But nothing in the executive order does this. It's why I think that the president's policy now doesn't in any way lessen the need for comprehensive enforcement and comprehensive immigration reform. And so I haven't heard prior comments of the president saying he didn't have the authority to do this. I think he so clearly does, and it's been exercised by other presidents before, as I said.
Yes, and the only thing I would add to that is that, you know, obviously the president was being pressured to take an action that he didn't want to take. The president wanted Congress to pass legislation, something that we all hope that Congress will do. And at that time, I think he was trying to rebuff pressure on him to use his legitimate executive powers to do what he could. And those statements are coming back to haunt him. But I think the context is important, and I think it hinges on that very specific thing, that the president cannot do what legislation can do, neither do these applications of prosecutorial discretion that he is putting on the table. Those are within his actions. Now, in the context of political theater, which, like many other complex issues, all are subjective to, I think that we're going to continue to hear that. There were two hearings today. One is happening right now. And I heard the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee ask again and again Secretary Jay Johnson about that very specific thing. So I don't think that there's going to be an easy putting it to rest, because in many ways immigration debate and legislation and conversations are a fact-free zone. But I think one way to address that is that the president cannot provide a path to green cards and citizenship like the Senate legislation did, and he is not doing that through this action.
And our next question will come from William Barker with Fins.
Yes. There have been a lot of questions raised, notably, of course, by the Republicans, as to how far the power to set enforcement priorities goes. So could a Republican president say, well, I'm just not going to enforce the capital gains tax?
Let me go back to the Office of Legal Counsel memo. They said there are four factors to be considered. One is a decision to decline enforcement to reflect factors peculiarly within the enforcing area agent's expertise. Second, the program may not effectively rewrite the laws in the guise of exercising enforcement discretion. The action must be consonant with broad congressional policy. Third, the program cannot be so extreme as to amount to an abdication of statutory responsibility. And fourth, non-enforcement is most commonly sustained on a case-by-case basis. And I think when future presidents try to invoke the authority to not bring enforcement actions, there's going to be a lot of attention to this Office of Legal Counsel memo. I think that said, it's important to recognize that presidents do have broad authority to choose whether to bring enforcement prosecutions or deportations. Now, in this instance, I think there's a strong argument that what President Obama has done is consistent with the statute, and it's consistent with prior precedent. If a president were not to enforce capital gains tax, I think you'd make the argument that the president is acting inconsistently with the statute. But even in those instances, I think it's going to be very hard to argue that choices not to bring prosecutions, choices to set priorities to enforcement, violate the Constitution. But I guess what I'm trying to say is there's no clear line here. The Office of Legal Counsel has tried to articulate a line, and it's an area where there aren't cases in the past that give us a clear line.
And I would add that, you know, there, I think in some quarters, for example, I think the Washington Post did a couple of very alarming editorials, which they walked back since, talking about how this was like tearing up the Constitution. I think that there are folks that are concerned about the expansion of presidential powers, and I think that is a subject that deserves a whole conversation in and of itself. But I think part of the complication here is melding perhaps disagreement on how a president uses the legitimate powers available to him or her and whether he actually has those powers or not. And so I think that we need to bifurcate those things. There could be a legitimate debate about what is the right use or how much of a use should there be. But in terms of whether they have the legitimate ability, I think that both the precedent and the legal cases are there to support that. And again, we go back here to the president. If the president was simply refusing to enforce immigration laws, period, the end, I think that's when they would be crossing over into actually violating the law and the extent of their powers. But I think as this conversation begun with the notion that they are able to deport 400,000 people a year, in many ways, the reason why we've seen the balance of those deportations come to people who have no criminal background records, a lot of times has to do also with the fact that in order to run the investigation that is going to net you people who are more of a criminal element, there's more work and investment that has to go to doing that. But in many ways, it is those removals that have the potential ability to make us safer. So the short of it is the president is going to continue to enforce the law. They are prioritizing on those things that are going to elevate national security and public safety.
And once again, if you would like to signal with questions, please press star 1. Again, that's star 1 if you'd like to ask a question.
I do have another question that came in over email. This one is directed for Clarissa and from Ruben Garcia. What are the employment ramifications of coming forward and claiming status? Can an employer fire a worker for being part of the program?
So there's going to be a number of things happening. I think I almost thought you were asking the other part of that employment question. As we know, a fair amount of the folks who are currently undocumented are indeed already working. And so for those that would be able to meet the criteria of these programs and come forward, they're going to have to demonstrate that they've been in the country for the period of time that is required. And for many of us, the easiest way to do that is through employment records, right? So what if that employer either didn't know or kind of pretended not to know that that person was undocumented? So I think in terms of the work that's going on right now before these programs start, another important point, the expansion of the DACA program, I think they had a 90-day window before that program would start. And the DAPA program, the one for parents, they had said would take about 180 days for that application process to start. That part of laying down the groundwork and the specifics of the application and the guidance that they provide, they are looking at, you know, holding employers harmless if they are able to provide records to folks, in some ways wiping that slate clean. But I have to say that I'm not yet completely sure of what would happen if a person came forward. I think that in many cases, the non-discrimination clauses have to apply. At the end of the day, what this person would do technically would be to come forward to the employer and present, say, if they were working with somebody else or a false Social Security number, they will now be doing a change of Social Security number.
And we'll take a question from Whitney Beard with ORC.
Hi. Sort of tagging on to that last question, I'm curious, what are the long-term implications for people who take advantage of this program? I'm assuming if there was a Republican president in office that he or she would reverse this executive order. Do they then put themselves in peril by signing up for this program?
That's an excellent question, and that's definitely a question that those of us on the advocacy and community side have had to grapple with in order to, you know, encourage people to come forward, for example, under the DACA program. Similar questions came up there. So the first thing is, it's true. If a new president comes in, they could say, "This, you know, I'm not going to continue this program. This is the end of it." Through the years, whether it's been in the course of discussing legislation or in the context of the DACA program or even, for example, in the process of applying for the ACA, I think that in all of those, there's always been a conversation about how to create firewalls that are going to enable us to convince people to come out of the shadows. I think that largely there is an understanding that is the greater good for people who come out of the shadows. So both in the context of legislative discussions, there's been confidentiality clauses about people coming forward and applying. Obviously,
that goes out the window if the person in question is somebody who is a serious criminal or a real threat, but that there are those confidentiality clauses. So in this case, I think that what people would be facing is the possibility that the program ends. And so right now it's a 3-year interval, at which point it's renewable. So the end of the first round of that program obviously would come in at the time when there is a new president. So yes, the reality is a new president could decide to end the program. I think the precedent and the environment that we're seeing is, you know, ironically enough, with all the debate about the president taking action and that has poisoned the well and now Congress will not be able to do anything, the interesting thing is that if you look at the past through all of those examples you heard about, in a lot of cases, presidential action has preceded legislative action. And in most of those cases, Congress has actually, for lack of a better word, ratified or codified through legislative channels what those presidents have done. In many ways, this could be a potential, I don't know, putting jumper cables to the car and putting pressure now on Republicans to bring their alternatives to the table. I think if you add the political dimension on that, obviously among Latinos, 75% of whom are United States citizens, by the way, but among Latino voters, over 60% of whom also know somebody who is undocumented, this issue is a high priority, and this program has incredible levels of support. I think as the political landscape continues to shift and the pressure on Republicans continues to grow, to put sound solutions on the table as a way to rebuild that relationship with this electorate, it's going to be a very high bar for a president to come in and undo that program without putting something else on the table.
And we'll take a question from Leslie Dellen with L. Dellen Immigration Law.
Yes, I was looking at the Republican hearing memorandum that was prepared of the Jed Johnson hearing, and the authors cite to a Supreme Court case called Galvin v. Press for the proposition that the formation of immigration policy is entrusted exclusively to Congress. So I was wondering whether you had a comment on that.
Well, so the difficulty with a statement that abstract is it's not very useful.
Right.
Congress alone gets to decide whether people are going to be allowed into the United States. Congress alone gets to decide who's going to get to be a citizen. Congress alone gets to decide who's going to have lawful status once here. And so in that sense, all of that is exclusively within congressional control. And President Obama's executive order is in no way inconsistent with that. And I think that's what Galvin was talking about in that context. Presidents have always set enforcement priorities with regard to immigration. It's never been the case that any president has tried to deport everybody who's discovered they're unlawfully in the United States. As the Supreme Court indicated in Arizona versus the United States just 2 years ago, presidents have often exercised this for humanitarian reasons, sometimes for foreign policy reasons. And so that's not inconsistent with what the court says in Galvin. And when you look at all of the examples of deferred action, of presidents who've chosen not to deport people as a group, I think you can see that Galvin's statement is just much too sweeping, and it's just inconsistent with how the government has always worked from the earliest days of American history.
Thank you very much, and we're about out of time now. Again, many thanks to Clarissa and Irwin and to all our participants for joining us on today's call. We'll have a follow-up call in the new year focused on informing lawyers, law students, and advocates on ways to provide assistance to those eligible for relief under the President's plan. And please remember to visit acslaw.org to renew your membership. And for CLE credit, please email Alicia Yass, again, that's A-Y-A-S-S, at acslaw.org. And thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
That does conclude today's conference. We do thank you for your participation today.